You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, The Importance of COVID-19 Management in Patients with Obesity, Recognizing and Addressing Risk. I'm Deb Gordon, and I'm thrilled to be joined by Dr. Christopher Palmer, Assistant Professor of Medicine at the University of Rochester in New York. This program focuses on monitoring patients with obesity and COVID-19 as they receive outpatient therapy. Welcome, Dr. Palmer.
Thanks for having me.
We know that more than half of Americans in this country have overweight or obesity issues. I believe we're at 40% have obesity these days, putting them at risk of more severe disease if they get COVID. What do you see if we just focus on the obesity situation? What do you see in your office?
You're quite right. Obesity has been an epidemic in the United States. I think it was Surgeon General Koop, during the Clinton administration that kind of used that language as an epidemic of obesity. So that's dating back 30 years now and keeps getting worse. Rates of obesity keep rising in the United States. It's also a global phenomenon too. It's certainly outside the US as well. We're seeing obesity rates trend up in, most parts of the world, especially in, large swaths of Asia. So it's a problem here. It's a progressively worsening problem in the United States. And there's been little progress in reducing rates of obesity. And it's becoming much more of a global phenomenon as well.
So let's then move into the issue of COVID. We learned early on in the pandemic that people with obesity, with or without underlying medical conditions, had a much higher risk of hospitalization, intubation, and death. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so from the very beginning stages of the pandemic, observational data was quite striking, with obesity being one of the more prominent risk factors for poor outcomes, meaning hospitalization or mechanical ventilation or death. That was seen very early on in the very first, cohorts of patients that were observed for outcomes. And it's held consistent throughout, 3.5 years of the, nearly 3.5 years now of the pandemic, where even today, even with access to, widespread access to vaccination, we're still seeing substantially higher rates of, or higher risk of poor outcomes in people with obesity, especially severe obesity. So a BMI of more than 40, that's really where the risk really escalates quite a bit. And, it's still on the order of, an odds ratio of, two, so meaning about twice the risk, somewhere right around two at this point. So you can think of obesity as something that more or less doubles your risk for, hospitalization or death from COVID.
Do we see lower rates of severe disease in those who have been vaccinated, fully vaccinated?
Vaccines are effective in people that are obese and as well as people that are normal weight. But the vaccine efficacy is less in people that are obese. And so that's an interesting observational outcome from the pandemic. And we've seen this with other vaccines in the past, but there's been more in-depth and high quality research with COVID, to be frank. And so we're seeing effects like, I think some of the really interesting effects are more recently published about vaccine responses in obese patients compared to non-obese patients. So there was a very large observational study from Scotland that was published in Nature Medicine last month in April.
Yeah, I think I saw that.
Yeah, looking at, essentially, you can, when you have nationalized healthcare, you can do these large studies of the entire population of Scotland, more or less. But, people that were obese in Scotland, responded well initially to vaccine. They made just as many useful and helpful and protective antibodies initially after vaccination. But the persistence of those antibodies was dramatically less, in the obese population. So those with a BMI of over 40, severe obesity, they had the rate of decay of those antibodies essentially be about twice as fast, so they're protected for about half the duration as a non-obese person. So, we're seeing all these interesting findings and a reminder that, obesity is more than just a disease of, people are very familiar with obesity causing cardiac disease and diabetes. But it's a reminder that diabetes, has a highly significant impact on the immune system. And we're seeing that emphasized again and again, not just in outcomes of COVID, but also, in vaccination rates and protection and all these other studies that are ongoing. And it's, you know, it's a reminder that, you know, insulin is a hormone and it affects many other cells, but so do many of these other hormones that are produced as a consequence of really severe obesity. You know, like leptins have effect on macrophage function and so does insulin. And so it's not all that surprising in retrospect to see significant changes between obese persons and non-obese persons in infectious outcomes.
How should clinicians talk to their patients with obesity about this topic, given how fraught the whole vaccine issue is to begin with? How do you talk to them?
Well, I think the important reminder is you don't want to make people feel that there's no point in vaccination, because that's not true at all. So, you know, if you're reminding somebody that they're increased risk and the vaccine's not going to work as well, you want to emphasize that the vaccine is going to work actually very well, just a shorter duration of time. So I would counsel patients that they really stand to benefit the most from being vaccinated. They should still be vaccinated. Or if they've been, you know, partially vaccinated, they should at least have at least one bivalent vaccine dose. So I would really strongly encourage patients about that and try and convey at the same time, you know, there's benefit to vaccination. You're just not going to benefit as much as everybody else. So you need to think about other things to do to try and protect yourself. You know, at this time, there's no approved pre-exposure prophylaxis of any kind. So, you know, Evusheld was on the market before, but it's, you know, unfortunately, that protective antibody product that's administered intramuscularly doesn't work against new variants, so it's off the market, and there's nothing that's replaced it to date. So I would counsel patients to be cautious. You know, if you're going to go into a very an environment with a large number of people indoors, maybe that's not the best setting for you to consider. So I would still recommend some form of risk mitigation for patients that are at higher risk for poor outcomes from COVID, especially, you know, we could think about, you know, our obese patients, especially our obese patients with other risk factors that are known, like diabetes and hypertension and hyperlipidemia, or if they have a chronic lung disease, especially, or end-stage renal, or chronic kidney disease, or especially end-stage renal disease. Those patients, I would really counsel, you know, maybe an indoor concert isn't the best idea. It's going to confer some risk, but it's a personal choice. And, you know, if you do choose to do that and then you wind up getting sick, you know, we should really think about other means to reduce your risk of a poor outcome. We have highly effective treatments for COVID. And so those would be patients I'd be strongly advising. If you do develop symptoms that could be compatible with COVID, first, you know, you need to get tested so we can know it's actually COVID and we can offer you some directed therapies that are effective. So if you're feeling not well, you have a fever or upper respiratory symptoms, it's worth doing a COVID test for those patients at home to help, you know, identify the culprit and then offer them directed treatment that could be very effective. And then I would, you know, emphasize again, you know, after you test, if you test positive, call us, you know, right away, and we should try and get you access to something that's highly effective. You know, the currently, you know, the most effective medication, you know, that's oral would be Tenofovir boosted nirmatrelvir, you know, or Paxlovid is the commercial name. That'd be an easy oral therapy. IV or Remdesivir is also very effective, but it's just hard to get access to as an IV. So I would come up with a plan for most patients, you know, that have significant obesity. You know, one, you know, think about risk mitigation, but we all like to do risky things, to be frank. So it's understandable. And if it's something really important, go ahead and do it and enjoy it. But, you know, make a plan for afterwards in case you do get sick. And that plan should involve, you know, access to testing. You know, if you have a home test, use it. If you have concerning symptoms after an exposure, and if you do wind up becoming sick, you know, we should really think about offering treatment that's highly effective in reducing risk of progression to severe disease in our patients at the most risk. And a big group of those patients are those with obesity.
We know how effective Paxlovid is, and yet studies show that less than half of clinicians understand its use and it's highly underprescribed. Why do you think this is, and how does this then affect, well, all patients, but particularly those with high-risk conditions like obesity?
Yeah, you know, so, you know, it's new, so there needs to be time for dissemination of information and adoption. So maybe that's part of the reluctance or the lower utilization of a highly effective medicine than you'd expect. You know, I think the other aspect is a lot of us are just, you know, exhausted and tired, and we're quick to dismiss, you know, COVID infections as, yeah, we've done that, we've seen that. You know, but the risk still remains. It's not like all persons are well protected from COVID at this point, even though many of us are much better protected than we were in the past. So, you know, I kind of view this as a simple like number needed to treat calculation in the back of my mind. And that number has changed dramatically over time, where, you know, the utility and the benefit of these antiviral medications was very high for the general public very early on, when a lot was unknown and individual immunity was substantially less across all of us. Now we really need to focus and remember that some people are still not as well protected by vaccination, and we have really effective tools to prevent poor outcomes, and we should use them. I mean, a 5-day course of an oral antiviral is hard to justify not using if you really think somebody has a substantial risk of winding up in the hospital. So the real question is, what is that risk? I think that's the hard thing for people to estimate in the office, you know, without, a predictive aid or tool to kind of spit that out to you. And it's hard because it's changed, you know, over time.
I think one reason too for a little hesitation with Paxlovid is the drug-drug interactions. And we know that people with obesity often have those comorbidities. They may be on antihypertensives, statins, diabetes drugs. Is that something to really worry about? Or if you just simply stop the drug for a few days, it should be fine?
Yeah, so Paxlovid is a combination of two medicines. The ritonavir component is the one with a lot of drug-drug interactions because of hepatic it's there to impair a specific hepatic enzyme to improve the availability of the antiviral component, or the COVID antiviral component, the nirmatrelvir. So those drug-drug interactions can come in two flavors. You know, either they're a drug-drug interaction that's going to effectively render the nirmatrelvir component inactive, in which case there's no point in using it. So if you have a long-acting drug that's going to alter CYP3A metabolism for a long time, you know, even if you stop the offending agent, you know, the CYP3A is upregulated and going to be around for a while, and it's just not going to work. So those class of interactions you're kind of stuck with. You just have to choose something else. And you think somebody's really high risk, you got to try and figure out access to something like remdesivir IV, or offer something else that's oral, like molnupiravir, that is less effective, but, you know, maybe easier to physically access. The other class of interactions can often be overcome by stopping the offending, you know, the interacting medication. So like a prime example I use all the time is atorvastatin, Lipitor. You know, you can just hold the Lipitor and you don't worry about, you know, the patient not being on their Lipitor for 5 days. That's not going to have a clinically meaningful impact. Tacrolimus is another one where, you know, simply stopping the tacrolimus is an effective means of mitigating the drug-drug interaction. The caveat is the reason people are often on tacrolimus is for things like graft rejection for their kidney transplant. And in that case, you know, that's a much, much harder decision to make. Is it safe to stop the tacro for 5 days? You know, are you going to wind up with some transplant rejection as a result of that? You know, those are very challenging decisions to make. It's probably easiest to just not use nirmatrelvir or ritonavir, not use Paxlovid in that case, and choose something else. So, you know, all these drug-drug interactions are complicated. You know, some of them are very easy, some of them are fairly complex and nuanced. I just highly suggest using a decision aid tool for this. You know, there are online databases that, you know, this is something that is perfect for, you know, a database search, like a, you know, an AI function to send out a recommendation for.
Right. So one more question. When you put your patients on an outpatient therapy, how do you monitor them? Or do you just tell them to call you when they're finished or if they have any additional symptoms?
So, you know, in general, you probably don't need to do any specific monitoring if you're using a course of Paxlovid related to the Paxlovid. You know, there are cases with drug-drug interactions where we may be changing an interacting drug and you may want to check a drug level, but those are pretty specific and unique. What I care most about is whether the patient's getting worse or better clinically. And so, you know, I always remind patients that if you're having signs of kind of progressive, you know, disease, and I'm really worried about lower respiratory disease, if you have any signs that are, you know, are strongly suggestive of developing worsening lower respiratory tract disease, you need to get in for, you know, some in-person evaluation, you know, likely in a tertiary care facility of some kind, an urgent care or an ED. So patients that are having new changes in mental status, that's highly concerning. Patients that have new onset hypoxia, if they have a home oximeter, are highly concerning. Patients with really just progressive dyspnea complaints, progressive shortness of breath complaints, you know, really do warrant reevaluation somewhere. So that's usually what I'm counseling patients about, you know, and I'm calling back to check on how they're doing clinically and not necessarily following up with any, you know, specific lab monitoring related to therapy.
So we're just about out of time. Is there anything I haven't asked you about that you'd like to say about this topic?
The effect of obesity on COVID, you know, has been, you know, both remarkable and not surprising at all. You know, this paradox, you know, in retrospect, it's not surprising that people that are obese have substantially higher risk. But it's remarkable how significant that risk is. You know, the degree, I think, is more than we kind of would have expected a priori from all this. And you know, it's a good reminder that, you know, it's worth counseling patients about high risk things that are common, like obesity. You know, we should all try and do a better job for managing obesity. That's really a challenge clinically. But at least the part of coming up with a treatment plan for something that's very treatable, like a SARS-CoV-2 infection, COVID, should be much more straightforward. And, you know, thankfully we have, you know, highly effective medications and a few of them available at the moment, and likely a few more to hit the market in the next year or two. So there's no shortage of treatment options. There's no excuse not to kind of think about treatment with your patients, especially those at risk, you know, especially multiple risk factors, obesity and kidney disease, or obesity and, you know, some immunocompromising condition. You know, we should really be doubling down our efforts to kind of protect our patients at the highest risk while the rest of us benefit from, you know, highly effective vaccines and a better day-to-day environment for ourselves. We need to not forget everybody else.
Right. Absolutely. Great. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about this. And I want to thank our listeners for joining us. We hope you'll listen to another episode from this series. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide CME for physicians. This activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. And I want to give a special thank you to our supporter, Pfizer, who provided an educational grant for this activity.